Chapter 32. Dr. Lionel Adams, B.A. of Yale, Ph.D. of Chicago, Negro, had been a journalist, American consul in Africa, and, at the time of Berzelius Windrip's election, professor of anthropology in Howard University. As with all his colleagues, his professorship was taken over by a most worthy and needy white man, whose training in anthropology had been as photographer on one expedition to Yucatan. In the dissension between the Booker Washington School of Negroes, who counseled patience in the new subjection of the Negroes to slavery, and the radicals, who demanded that they join the communists and struggle for the economic freedom of all, white or black, Professor Adams took the mild Fabian former position. He went over the country preaching to his people that they must be realistic and make what future they could, not in some utopian fantasy, but on the inescapable basis of the ban against them. Near Burlington, Vermont, there is a small colony of Negroes, truck farmers, gardeners, houseworkers, mostly descended from slaves who, before the Civil War, escaped to Canada by the Underground Railway conducted by such zealots as Truman Webb's grandfather, but who sufficiently loved the land of their forcible adoption to return to America after the war. From the colony had gone to the great cities young colored people who, before the Corpo Emancipation, had been nurses, doctors, merchants, officials. This colony Professor Adams addressed, bidding the young colored rebels to seek improvement within their own souls rather than in mere social superiority. As he was in person unknown to this Burlington colony, Captain Oscar Ledoux, nicknamed Shad, was summoned to censor the lecture. He sat hulked down in a chair at the back of the hall. Aside from addresses by M.M. officers and moral inspiration by his teachers in grammar school, it was the first lecture he had ever heard in his life, and he didn't think much of it. He was irritated that this stuck-up nigger didn't spiel like the characters of Octavius Roy Cohen, one of Shad's favorite authors, but had the nerve to try to sling English just as good as Shad himself. It was more irritating that the loud-mouthed pup should look so much like a bronze statue. And finally, it was simply more than a guy could stand that the big bum should be wearing a tuxedo. So when Adams, as he called himself, claimed that there were good poets and teachers and even doctors and engineers among the niggers, which was plainly an effort to incite folks to rebellion against the government, Shad signaled his squad and arrested Adams in the midst of his lecture, addressing him, "You goddamn dirty, ignorant, stinking nigger. I'm gonna shut your big mouth for you for keeps." Dr. Adams was taken to the Trianon concentration camp. Ensign Stoit thought it would be a good joke on those fresh beggars, almost communists, you might say, Jessup and Pascal, to lodge the nigger right in the same cell with them. But they actually seemed to like Adams, talked to him as though he were white and educated. So Stoit placed him in a solitary cell where he could think over his crime in having bitten the hand that had fed him. The greatest single shock that ever came to the Trianon camp was in November 1938, when there appeared among them as the newest prisoner, Shad Ledoux. It was he who was responsible for nearly half of them being there. The prisoners whispered that he had been arrested on charges by Francis Tasbro, officially for having grafted on shopkeepers, unofficially for having failed to share enough of the graft with Tasbro. But such cloudy causes were less discussed than the question of how they would murder Shad now they had him safe. All Minutemen who were under discipline, except only such Reds as Julian Falk, were privileged prisoners in the concentration camps. They were safeguarded against the common, i.e. criminal, i.e. political, inmates, and most of them, once reformed, were returned to the MM ranks, with a greatly improved knowledge of how to flog malcontents. Chad was housed by himself in a single cell like a not-too-bad hall bedroom, and every evening he was permitted to spend 2 hours in the officer's mess room. The scum could not get at him because his exercise hour was at a time different from theirs. Doremus begged the plotters against Chad to restrain themselves. "Good Lord, Doremus, do you mean that after the sure enough battles we've gone through, you're still a bourgeois pacifist? That you still believe in the sanctity of a lump of hog meat like Ledoux?" demanded Carl Paschal. "Well, yes, I do. A little. I know that Chad came from a family of 12 underfed brats up on Mount Terror. Not much chance. But more important than that, I don't believe in individual assassination as an effective means of fighting despotism. The blood of the tyrants is the seed of the massacre, and are you taking a cue from me and quoting sound doctrine when it's the time for a little liquidation?" said Carl. "This one tyrant's going to lose a lot of blood." The Paschal, whom Doremus had considered as, at his most violent, only a gas bag, looked at him with a stare in which all friendliness was frozen. Carl demanded of his cellmates, a different set now than at Doremus's arrival, "Shall we get rid of this typhus germ, Ledoux?" John Polycop, Truman Webb, the surgeon, the carpenter, each of them nodded, slowly, without feeling. At exercise hour, the discipline of the men marching out to the quadrangle was broken when one prisoner stumbled with a cry, knocked over another man, and loudly apologized, just at the barred entrance of Chad Ledoux's cell. The accident made a knot collect before the cell. Doremus, on the edge of it, saw Chad looking out, his wide face blank with fear. Someone, somehow, had lighted and thrown into Chad's cell a large wad of waste soaked with gasoline. It caught the thin wallboard which divided Chad's cell from the next. The whole room looked presently like the firebox of a furnace. Chad was screaming as he beat at his sleeves, his shoulders. Doremus remembered the scream of a horse clawed by wolves in the far north. When they got Chad out, he was dead. He had no face at all. Captain Cowlick was deposed as superintendent of the camp and vanished to the insignificance whence he had come. He was succeeded by Shad's friend, the belligerent Snake Tizra, now a battalion leader. His first executive act was to have all the 200 inmates drawn up in the quadrangle and to announce, "I'm not going to tell you guys anything about how I'm going to feed you or sleep you till I've finished putting the fear of God into every one of you murderers." There were offers of complete pardon for anyone who would betray the man who had thrown the burning waste into Shad's cell. It was followed by enthusiastic private offers from the prisoners that anyone who did thus tattle would not live to get out. So, as Doremus had guessed, they all suffered more than Shad's death had been worth. And to him, thinking of Sissy, thinking of Shad's testimony at Hanover, it had been worth a great deal. It had been very precious and lovely. A court of special inquiry was convened, with Provincial Commissioner Effingham Swan himself presiding. He was very busy with all bad works. He used aeroplanes to be about them. 10 prisoners, 1 out of every 20 in the camp, were chosen by lot and shot summarily. Among them was Professor Victor Loveland, who, for all his rags and scars, was neatly academic to the last, with his eyeglasses and his slick tow-colored hair parted in the middle, as he looked at the firing squad. Suspects like Julian Falk were beaten more often, kept longer in those cells in which one could not stand, sit, nor lie. Then, for 2 weeks in December, all visitors and all letters were forbidden, and newly arrived prisoners were shut off by themselves, and the cellmates, like boys in a dormitory, would sit up till midnight in whispered discussion as to whether this was more vengeance by Snake Tizra, or whether something was happening in the world outside that was too disturbing for the prisoners to know. Chapter 33. When the Fox and John Polycop had been arrested and had joined her father in prison, when such more timid rebels as Mungo Kitterick and Harry Kinderman had been scared away from new underground activities, Mary Greenhill had to take over the control of the Fort Beulah cell, with only Sissy, Father Parafix, Dr. Olmsted and his driver, and half a dozen other agents left. And control it she did, with angry devotion and not too much sense. All she could do was to help in the escape of refugees and to forward such minor anti-corpo news items as she could discover, with Julian gone. The demon that had grown within her ever since her husband had been executed now became a great tumor, and Mary was furious at inaction. Quite gravely, she talked about assassinations, and long before the day of Mary Greenhill, daughter of Doremus, gold-armored tyrants in towers had trembled at the menace of young widows in villages among the dark hills. She wanted first to kill Shad Ladue, who, she did not know but guessed, had probably done the actual shooting of her husband. But in this small place it might hurt her family even more than they had been hurt. She humorlessly suggested, before Shad was arrested and murdered, that it would be a pretty piece of espionage for Sissy to go and live with him. The once flippant Sissy, so thin and quiet ever since her Julian had been taken away, was certain that Mary had gone mad, and at night was terrified. She remembered how Mary, in the days when she had been a crystal-hard, crystal-bright sportswoman, had with her riding crop beaten a farmer who had tortured a dog. Mary was fed up with the cautiousness of Dr. Olmsted and Father Parafix, men who rather liked a vague state called freedom, but did not overmuch care for being lynched. She stormed at them. Call themselves men? Why didn't they go out and do something? At home, she was irritated by her mother, who lamented hardly more about Doremus's jailing than she did about the beloved little tables that had been smashed during his arrest. It was equally the blasts about the greatness of the new provincial commissioner, Effingham Swan, in the Corpo Press, and memoranda in the secret NU reports about his quick death verdicts against prisoners, that made her decide to kill this dignitary. Even more than Shad, who had not yet been sent to Trianon, she blamed him for Fowler's fate. She thought it out quite calmly. That was the sort of thinking that the Corpos were encouraging among decent homebody women by their program for revitalizing national American pride. Except with babies accompanying mothers, two visitors together were forbidden in the concentration camps. So when Mary saw Doremus and, in another camp, Buck Titus in early October, she could only murmur, in almost the same words to each of them, "Listen. When I leave you, I'll hold up David. But heavens, what a husky lump he's become, at the gate, so you can see him. If anything should ever happen to me, if I should get sick or something, when you get out, you'll take care of David. Won't you? Won't you?" She was trying to be matter of fact, that they might not worry. She was not succeeding very well. So she drew out from the small fund which her father had established for her after Fowler's death enough money for a couple of months, executed a power of attorney by which either her mother or her sister could draw the rest, casually kissed David and Emma and Sissy goodbye, and, chatty and gay as she took the train, went off to Albany, capital of the northeastern province. The story was that she needed a change and was going to stay near Albany with Fowler's married sister. She did actually stay with her sister-in-law, long enough to get her bearings. 2 days after her arrival, she went to the New Albany training field of the Corpo Women's Flying Corps and enlisted for lessons in aviation and bombing. When the inevitable war should come, when the government should decide whether it was Canada, Mexico, Russia, Cuba, Japan, or perhaps Staten Island that was menacing her borders and proceed to defend itself outwards, then the best women flyers of the Corps were to have commissions in an official army auxiliary. The old-fashioned rights granted to women by the liberals might, for their own sakes, be taken from them, but never had they had more right to die in battle. While she was learning, she wrote to her family reassuringly, mostly postcards to David, bidding him mind whatever his grandmother said. She lived in a lively boarding house filled with MM officers who knew all about and talked a little about the frequent inspection trips of Commissioner Swan by aeroplane. She was complimented by quite a number of insulting proposals there. She had driven a car ever since she had been 15, in Boston traffic, across the Quebec plains, on rocky hill roads in a blizzard. She had made repairs at midnight. And she had an accurate eye, nerves trained outdoors, and the resolute steadiness of a madman evading notice while he plots death. After 10 hours of instruction by an MM aviator who thought the air was as good a place as any to make love in and who could never understand why Mary laughed at him, she made her first solo flight with an admirable landing. The instructor said, among other things less apropos, that she had no fear, that the one thing she needed for mastery was a little fear. Meantime, she was an obedient student in classes in bombing, a branch of culture daily more propagated by the corpos. She was particularly interested in the Mills hand grenade. You pulled out the safety pin, holding the lever against the grenade with your fingers, and tossed. 5 seconds after the lever was thus loosened, the grenade exploded and killed a lot of people. It had never been used from planes, but it might be worth trying, thought Mary. MM officers told her that Swan, when a mob of steel workers had been kicked out of a plant and started rioting, had taken command of the peace officers and himself, they chuckled with admiration of his readiness, hurled such a grenade. It had killed 2 women and a baby. Mary took her 6th solo flight on a November morning, gray and quiet under snow clouds. She had never been very talkative with the ground crew, but this morning she said it excited her to think she could leave the ground like a regular angel and shoot up and hang around that unknown wilderness of clouds. She patted a strut of her machine, a high-wing Leonard monoplane with open cockpit, a new and very fast military machine meant for both pursuit and quick jobs of bombing, quick jobs of slaughtering a few hundred troops in close formation. At the field, as she had been informed he would, District Commissioner Effingham Swan was boarding his big official cabin plane for a flight, presumably into New England. He was tall, a distinguished, military-looking, polo-suggesting dignitary in masterfully simple blue serge, with just a light flying helmet. 12 yes-men buzzed about him, secretaries, bodyguards, a chauffeur, a couple of county commissioners, educational directors, labor directors, their hats in their hands, their smiles on their faces, their souls wriggling with gratitude to him for permitting them to exist. He snapped at them a good deal and bustled. As he mounted the steps to the cabin, Mary thought of Casey Jones and smiled. A messenger on a tremendous motorcycle blared up with the last telegrams. There seemed to be 60 of the yellow envelopes, Mary marveled. He tossed them to the secretary, who was humbly creeping after him. The door of the vice-regal coach closed on the commissioner, the secretary, and 2 bodyguards lumpy with guns. It was said that in his plane Swan had a desk that had belonged to Hitler, and before him to Marat. To Mary, who had just lifted herself up into the cockpit, a mechanic cried, admiringly pointing after Swan's plane as it lurched forward, "Gee, what a grand guy that is, Boss Swan. I hear where he's flying down to Washington to chin with the chief this morning. Gee, think of it, with the chief. Wouldn't it be awful if somebody took a shot at Mr. Swan and the chief? Might change all history," Mary shouted down. "No chance of that. See those guards of his? Say, they could stand off a whole regiment. They could lick Walt Trowbridge and all the other communists put together." "I guess that's so. Nothing but God shooting down from heaven could reach Mr. Swan. Ha ha, that's good. A couple days ago I heard where a fellow was saying he figured out God had gone to sleep.
Maybe it's time for him to wake up, said Mary, and raised her hand.
Her plane had a top of 285 miles an hour. Swan's golden chariot had but 230. She was presently flying above and a little behind him. His cabin plane, which had seemed huge as the Queen Mary when she had looked up at its wings spread on the ground, now seemed small as a white dove, wavering above the patchy linoleum that was the ground. She drew from the pockets of her flying jacket the 3 mm hand grenades she had managed to steal from the school yesterday afternoon. She had not been able to get away with any heavier bomb. As she looked at them, for the first time she shuddered. She became a thing of warmer blood than a mere attachment to the plane, mechanical as the engine.
Better get it over before I go ladylike, she sighed, and dived at the cabin plane.
No doubt her coming was unwelcome. Neither Death nor Mary Greenhill had made a formal engagement with Effingham Swan that morning. Neither had telephoned, nor bargained with irritable secretaries, nor been neatly typed down on the great lord's schedule for his last day of life. In his dozen offices, in his marble home, in council hall and royal reviewing stand, his most precious excellence was guarded with steel. He could not be approached by vulgarians like Mary Greenhill, save in the air, where emperor and vulgarian alike are upheld only by toy wings and by the grace of God. 3 times Mary maneuvered above his plane and dropped a grenade. Each time it missed. The cabin plane was descending to land, and the guards were shooting up at her. Oh, well, she said, and dived bluntly at a bright metal wing. In her last 10 seconds, she thought how much the wing looked like the zinc washboard, which, as a girl, she had seen used by Mrs. Candy's predecessor. Now, what was her name? Mamie or something. And she wished she had spent more time with David the last few months. And she noticed that the cabin plane seemed rather rushing up at her than she down at it. The crash was appalling. It came just as she was patting her parachute and rising to leap out. Too late. All she saw was an insane whirligig of smashed wings and huge engines that seemed to have been hurled up into her face.